The Asian Classics Institute presents A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Part 3, with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in October of 1997. This is the beginning of Class 10. Sashi Bhagi Jashi Neta Jam Rira Vinci Nyende Yampadi Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Dogo Nanda Shimla
Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dagni Kyasuchi Dagi Chunyen Dipe Sunangi Drola Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma
survivors in this class. No, congratulations for that, because I think it's the most difficult class we've had, course we've had, and I didn't expect this many survivors, so that's good. We've reached the final verses of the ninth chapter, the chapter on wisdom. This chapter is so difficult that in Tibetan monasteries, there were separate commentaries written just for the ninth chapter. And people who tried to translate it have always ended up, you know, giving up and translating the verses, and they just make it into a long paragraph or something like that, which you can see, because it doesn't make a lot of sense, just the verses themselves. And you can tell that Gyaltsep Jay is really stretching to fit the meaning into his commentary. So we've covered all the difficult sections. We've gone over all the different interpretations of emptiness from all the different schools. He's defeated all the other schools. He's gone through a lot of other worldviews, and he's eliminated them. And now it's like the last verses of the ninth chapter. And what does he choose to talk about in the last verses? Master Shantideva. By the way, there's a 10th chapter and we have to do that tonight too, but that's pretty short. So it's interesting what he chooses to make his last, the very last verses. And he talks about the best way, you know, if things are empty, if all things are empty, and if nothing has any nature of its own, and if it's our karma that gives things their nature, then what would be the most powerful karma of all to collect? And I think in his mind, Master Shantideva is deciding his audience, whoever was left by that point, right? He did all this in one afternoon, I guess, right? The whole book. And I think towards the end, he's deciding, let me leave them with the one karma which is the most powerful karma of all. Because if you understand that everything is empty, then you would want to go directly to doing the most powerful karma of all, okay? And he does. He starts talking about that, okay? Which is the karma of compassion, okay? The karma of wanting to spend the rest of your life to help other beings achieve their goals, and to keep the teachings in this world. You know, so he's talking about that in the final lines of the ninth chapter. So here we go with that. He starts out with the definition of two states of mind, which I've translated as love and compassion. Okay, and I'll give you the description of them. I dug around to find a short description because I didn't want you to have too much homework on your last class. So this is a description of love and compassion and the difference between love and compassion, according to Jetsun Kapa in his Lamrim Chemo. Okay, and it's very short, and I thought you would appreciate how short it is. Okay. Say dewa,
dang, tede, ki, jamba, dang, dunya, dang, telnde, ki, ningje.
Okay. Dewa means happiness. All right. Dewa means happiness. I used to mix it up with gewa, which means virtue. So don't do that. Okay. Dewa means happiness. Dang te means meet up with it, to encounter it, or to meet up with it. Okay. De means you want them. You want them to do that. And then Jampa, which is the name of that nice monk out in New Jersey, Jampa means love. Okay. Love. So the function of love is to wish that people should meet with every kind of happiness. Okay? The function of love is that you want to get them every kind of happiness that there is. All living beings.
Okay.
Dung means and. Dungyal means
suffering.
Dung tel means to be separated from or freed from. Freed from.
Okay. Dur means wants. And Ningjie
means compassion. So compassion, on the other hand, Ningjie. By the way, Ning means heart, and Jie means the Lord of all hearts. It's a beautiful word. And it's defined as the desire that all living beings be freed from suffering. Okay? So you get the difference. One state of mind wants that all beings should be freed from suffering, and the other state of mind wants to make sure they get all happiness. And then there's this huge debate in the monastery about which one comes first. When you teach the seven-step method for getting bodhicitta, one comes first. But when you think about it logically, the other one comes first, and there's this big debate about it. Okay, but basically, if you think about the metaphor of a child and a mother wanting to take care of her child, if the child were sick, if the child had a fever, then first the mother would seek to remove the child's pain. And then only afterwards would they give the child a toy. You see what I mean? If the child is still in pain, you wouldn't think about giving the child a toy. So the goal is first to remove people's pain and then get them to a tantric paradise. Right? I mean, that's the goal. So in practice, Ningjie comes first. You want to remove people's pain. And then secondly, you want to get them to the goal of happiness. And it's interesting that at this point, and this is probably the most important thing tonight from the ninth chapter, what Master Shantideva is saying is, I've just presented emptiness. You understand emptiness now perfectly. So that means that it's time for you to feel these two emotions. And he prays at the end of the ninth chapter. He says, I pray that I can get these two states of mind. You know, and I pray, and this is very important, I pray that I can have an understanding of emptiness while I'm having these two states of mind. You see what I mean? He's praying at the end of the ninth chapter that when I look at people and want to remove their suffering, I pray that I can understand the emptiness. And when I look at people and wish that I could give them whatever they wish, I pray that I can understand their emptiness. You see, and he's saying equally, now that I've understood emptiness, I know that the most important thing to do is to take care of other people. Okay? Like, he gets it. And he sort of like wants to leave you with that from the ninth chapter. Okay? That's the most important thing you can do with your emptiness. It doesn't help to understand emptiness if you don't do something with it. So he's saying now, love people, because now you understand. I think, really, if you understand emptiness well, you understand that love could work. You see what I mean? If people were self-existent, if all the people who suffer in New York, and they're not suffering just physically, but I think almost everybody is suffering mentally. If you took all the beings in New York, if they were self-existent, you see, if their suffering was self-existent, then things are hopeless. And I think a lot of intelligent people end up like abusing drugs or abusing alcohol or getting deep into business or something to distract themselves from that suffering. It's too much. It's too heavy. You don't want to think about it. And I think what makes people almost crazy in this world, in this city, intelligent, normal people, is that they really don't believe there's anything they can do for other people. You know, they really don't believe that there's any way you can really help other people. You understand that you could feed them. You understand that you could give them a place to stay. And you also understand from reading the daily news that every wealthy person in New York is also suffering. So you're almost, I think, an intelligent person, a normal person like anyone here, is kind of considers it, in your bottom of your heart, you consider it kind of hopeless to help anybody. I mean, you could go start a soup kitchen and maybe you could help 50 people and then you would get old and die. And you see that and you know that. And you kind of, in your heart, you feel like not doing that because you know how hopeless it is. You know what I mean? Because they're going to die, you're going to die. What's the use of having some soup or not? And you just sort of go into some kind of denial about it. You see what I mean? But if things are empty, then you can do something for other people. You see what I mean? You can teach them to feed themselves. You can teach them to make their own money. You can teach them to make their own paradise. You see what I mean? And if they were not empty, all those things would be impossible. So it's appropriate that at the end of studying emptiness, you get this huge feeling of love for people and compassion. You can have now, logically, or a functional feeling of compassion, because now you know you can do something. Because until you study the ninth chapter, frankly, things are pretty hopeless. If the mental unhappiness of everyone in New York is self-existent, then things are hopeless. And if their physical life and the fact of their death and their old age and their sickness, if that were self-existent, then things are hopeless. You know, and you've sensed that, and you've always sensed that. You know, I worked for the farm workers for 2 years. You know, I was on picket lines. I worked in all over the place. I stood up the Teamsters, you know. People got run over by trucks. You know, and we worked for the poor, you know. And then they were just as poor at the end as they were at the beginning, you know. And it was like, what do you do, you know? You just kind of, you know, when you're 20 or 22, you can do that. But when you get 30, it's like, what can I do to help people, you know? There's nothing I can do, you know. And the people who did end up getting their farm workers' rights and their farm workers' pay, they ended up watching TV in their little house, and they ended up going to nursing homes and dying anyway. And then you're just like, what can I do? You know, it doesn't seem to mean anything. But if they're empty, the whole ball game is changed. You know, if people are empty and if their suffering is empty, then you can really do something. You know, then you can really change them. You can help them move to a Buddha paradise in this lifetime. And then, you know, you get some more inspiration to be compassionate and to have love. Because now you have something you can do for them. And you sense it, and you know it. From this class, you sense that it's true. And now you have to think about what you can do to pull it off. Okay. So here you see the two sides of love. It's almost one word in English, right? Love. But in Tibetan, it's jampa and nyingje. The jampa part means you want them to get every good thing in the world. The compassion part is that you want them to be free of every suffering in the world. Okay? And now you can do it because things are empty. Okay? They are empty. If they weren't empty, it's hopeless. Things are hopeless. Because they are empty, because their minds are empty and their bodies are empty and their situation is empty, now there's a chance. Now we can do something. You got to get that. Okay? The ninth chapter is not just an exercise in philosophy. He closes it with compassion because he wants you to get it. that now things are possible. You know, now we can really help people. Now we can do something for people. You see what I mean? It's possible that we could go to a Buddha paradise. It's possible that you could change into a different kind of body. And it's possible that you could teach other people to do that. There's no problem with that. And in America, the opportunity is perfect. You know, people are well educated. People have enough food. They can think, they can study. People are fairly comfortable. People have free time. That's why the television exists. You know, that's why movies exist. People have enough time. People also suffer. You know, we know, we're sophisticated enough to know that mentally we suffer as badly as anyone else on the planet, even though we have enough to eat and we have nice houses and everything else. But we understand that almost every American in their heart, they know that they suffer as much as people in South India or something like that, and mentally. So Americans are quite ripe. You know, we also don't have any religion. You know what I mean? There's nothing. People are hungry. People need something. You know, there's some religions that don't seem to work very well, and there's a lot of people who don't follow any religion. And so people are missing that. It's like an essential vitamin or a protein in their life, and you feel the lack of it. You know, even I eat vegetables from time to time. I get this craving for green vegetables, you know, because my body says something's missing, you know. And I think people in America, you know, I did all these interviews of people who came to class for a long time. Now Ellie's doing them. But people want something. I mean, people grew up, they rejected their religion when they were younger, or they didn't reject it, but they don't think it works. And it doesn't. And you're hungry for something. And that's why people come to classes, and that's why people order. 10,000 tapes have gone out. You know, we didn't advertise. There's a little thing in the back of Tricycle or something, I think. It's just word of mouth. But people need it. People want it. And if there's something that works, then you have some personal responsibility to help them get it. You know what I mean? I don't mean, you know, what do you call it? What's the people come door to door and, you know, keep... anybody. Yeah. Not like that. You know, we're not allowed to go door to door and bother people like that. But if people are interested and they want to know, it's your responsibility to be ready. And to be ready to help them in an authentic way. Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the technical definition of great compassion. And it's a little bit long, but it's very beautiful. So bear with it. That's the longest thing tonight. I think I'll do this. This is my last shot at you, so I'm trying to make it really long. Okay. Say dunya, chengi, semchen, kangla, mikyang, ma, buchikpa, la, tsewe, su, samdu, dunya, tang, tower, dope, lo, chema, member, rangi, nangi, kewe, law. Okay. Dunya means suffering. Chen here means who is suffering. Chengi means who is suffering. Semchen means any living being. The gangla is the any, okay? Any living being. Mik means to focus on them. Okay, to focus on them. So the first quality of great compassion is that it focuses on a living being who is suffering, okay? Gyang means no matter which one it focuses on, okay? No matter which one it's focusing on, kyang. Pu means child, child. Chikpa means only child. Yeah. Say again. Oh, I'm sorry. You can put the ma here. Ma means mother. Okay. Bhu means child. Chikpa means only. La means towards that child. Tsewe. Tsewe here means love. It's another word for love. Tsutsamdu here means no less than that. No less than that. So what do we have so far? This state of mind focuses on any particular being who is suffering. Okay? And no matter which one it's focusing on, the feeling is no less than a mother has for their only child. If there's a mother who had only one child, the feeling you have for those beings is no less than that. The love you have for them is no less than that. Okay? Exactly that amount. Okay? By the way, if you're like me, I mean, I would like to have that kind of compassion. I have a feeling that if you had that kind of compassion, your life would be something extraordinary. You know what I mean? I think if you had half or a quarter of that compassion, you'd be blissful all the time. You know, I have a feeling that it's the key to happiness to have this kind of compassion. You know, I personally, it always escaped me. You know what I mean? I can't walk down the street and someone's irritating me or someone's doing some stupid thing and I can't. He says no matter who, see, Kangla, no matter who you're focusing on, you feel like they're your only child. You feel this love, overwhelming love for them as if they were your only child. And for me, that's difficult. You know what I mean? And I always thought it's like the Holy Grail. You know, if you could get to that, your life would be special. You know, if you understand the person's emptiness, I think you can get it a lot easier. You see what I mean? I think you could get this kind of love a lot easier. And that's why people who see emptiness directly have this extraordinary event, this extraordinary experience of bodhicitta right afterwards, okay, who are on the Mahayana track. They have this extraordinary experience of bodhicitta right after they see emptiness. And I think the point is that for the first time you realize that every suffering of this world is unnecessary. You know what I mean? All the death that's going on in this world, all the struggle between people, all the unhappiness of individuals, all the unhappiness that people have about each other, you know, every cut on a kid's finger, you know, every kind of terrible thing that ever goes on, from the slightest headache to the atomic bomb, you know, in Japan or something, from those, the whole range of suffering, the entire mental suffering of the United States, you know, it's all totally unnecessary. I think when you see emptiness directly, or you have a deep understanding of emptiness, and you see that all this dying and all this fighting is just not necessary, that it's just based on people not understanding emptiness, that then you start to get some feeling of real compassion for them, you know, because it's needless suffering. They don't have to die like that. They don't have to suffer like that. And they just didn't understand it yet. There's probably planets where, or there's probably countries on planets where everybody got it already, and there's no more suffering on that planet. You know what I mean? There's probably planets where Buddhas have done their thing very effectively. The people were ripe, and then just everybody on that planet understands emptiness. They follow their vows. They keep their book. No one's hurting anyone. And just people are just happy, you know, and people don't suffer, and people don't die like they die here. And this, so we're like somewhere lower on the evolutionary track, you know, and in this planet, in the realm that we're in, people didn't get it yet. And very, very, very few people understand that what will really make the world happy and that you can stop death, you see, and that you can stop every single form of suffering, mental or physical, that it's all I mean, if you really, really understand emptiness and you get this true realization in your heart that it's all a big waste, that it's all unnecessary suffering, people don't have to live like that, then I think you can get it, the feeling a little easier. It's a little more easy to, if you look around and realize that all this pain is unnecessary and it's just a mistake, that you could fix it, then it's, for me, it's easier to have compassion for people.
Really?
Okay, dunya means suffering, mental or physical. Dang Jawa means to be free of that suffering, to be free of that suffering. Dupa means you want it. Lo means that state of mind, that state of mind. Chimamimba means when you first practice compassion for other people, it's what we call contrived. It's artificial. You know, you have to sit there and say, "Oh, I really love all these sentient beings, even my boss." You know, you feel like it's your obligation to say it, but you don't feel it at all. That's what we call contrived bodhicitta or artificial bodhicitta or something like that. It's also like kirim, okay? If you have that teaching, it's very similar to kirim. Kirim is also called takpen nyonzo, which means the yoga of pretending. You see what I mean? So there is a step, a necessary step, where you pretend to have compassion, where you pretend to have love for people, because that helps you develop the real thing. Chimamimba means the real thing. Chimamimba means not pretend. It's not pretend. It's the real thing. Pretending is not a bad thing. You have to pretend you love people and act like that for a while, and then you can learn how to do it really. You know, you just keep practicing it until it becomes real. Okay. You don't feel it right away, but you keep trying. Okay. Rangi Ngangi means... I had a good translation of that. What was that? Uncontrollable wish. Okay. Rangi Ngangi means uncontrollable. It just comes up in you. You can't stop it. Okay. Yeah? Which one? Which one? It's Ngang. Okay.
Oh. Yeah, you can say Ngang if you want. Ngang. Okay.
Nangi, kewa means it comes up in you. Lo means that state of mind. It's a state of mind that comes up in you uncontrollably. By the time you get to great compassion, you can't stop it anymore. Okay? It just keeps coming up in your heart.
So we can define it. I'll read you the definition. I mean, in English, okay?
What is this a definition of? Great compassion. Okay, mahakaruna, you know? Ningje chembo. Definition, that uncontrived state of mind, which no matter what suffering being it may focus upon, okay, no matter what suffering being it may focus upon. It means you can't leave out your boss and your cousin and people like that. Feels an uncontrollable wish to free them from their pain. With exactly the same intensity. With exactly the same intensity of love. That a mother feels for her only child. Again, if you understand, I think, you know, everyone would like to have it. We don't have it. How can you get it?
for me personally, it's a lot easier if I think of their emptiness. Because then it becomes not only people who are in pain, they're in pain because they're doing it to themselves. You see what I mean? And that becomes, to me, very pitiful. You know, and then I can get, then I can feel compassion. You know what I mean? It's a lot easier for me. They are suffering. For every suffering they have, they are causing to themselves. And everything they do during the day to make themselves happy is backfiring, and they don't get it. You see what I mean? Now that's like watching a kid play with a razor blade or something and cut themselves, and it just feels bad. It'd be one thing if the kid, like, if something fell on the kid accidentally or something like that. That's one thing. But to see a kid sit there with a razor blade and cut themselves up, you know, you almost can't stop but feel sad for them. You know, an entire planet, 3 billion people, are cutting their own fingers, and they don't get it. You know, they don't understand, and they haven't been exposed to this, the truth, which is that it can stop, and they can stop it, but not by collecting bad karma. You know, they have to stop that. They have to understand what really causes other things, and it's not cheating or lying or money or things like that. You know, what causes a Michael and Zoe's milkshake is not doing something to hurt someone else. It's taking care of other people, but people don't get it. So you have a whole planet covered with people who are suffering, and they're doing it to themselves. That's the hard part, I think. You know, it must be hard for Buddhists to watch us, I think. You know, it must be kind of sad for them. It must be very poignant for them. They could see from 2,000 years ago that we would be doing this. And they probably have to watch it throughout all time, and that it must be very painful to watch, you know. Two types of great compassion. Say Semchen, Dungya, Dang, Telde, Ki, Ningje, Chembo. Semchen means living beings. Dungya means suffering. Dang Telde means wants to free them from suffering. And Ningje Chembo means great compassion. So the first kind of great compassion is the one that hopes to free people from their suffering. Okay? That's the first kind of great compassion. There's this huge debate in Mahayana literature. Like, can Hinayana people have this compassion? Can people on Hinayana track have this compassion? And the conclusion of Jetsun Kapa, for example, is yes, they can. They can have that. Daya means suffering. Okay, it just means that. Meaning that same suffering that we just mentioned. Dele Kyop means to protect people from that suffering. To protect people from that suffering. Okay. Do means it wants to. And Ningje Chembo means great compassion. So, by the way, don't confuse this with the three kinds of compassion you had the other class, you know, the one that just focuses on a person, and then the one that focuses on their impermanence and other qualities, and then the one which focuses upon their emptiness or something like that. Don't confuse it with those three. This is now a division into two. Okay. The first one is a general wish that people be freed from suffering. The second one wants to protect them from the suffering. Okay, what's the difference? I mean, in your mind, what's the difference? The first one wants to see them get freed from their suffering. The second one wants to protect them from their suffering. Okay, it's the difference between thinking in your mind, it's a pity that there's 3 billion people on this planet who are trying to be happy, and because they don't understand emptiness, every single action they undertake to be happy actually causes them suffering. You see what I mean? That's a pity to watch that go on. The better you understand emptiness, the more of a pity it will seem to you. I mean, you go out on the street and watch people drive or walk or move or go into a store, and every kind of human activity, you know, all commerce, all social interaction, it's all based on not understanding emptiness. And everything they're doing to be happy is actually causing them suffering. And it's some kind of pity to watch that. That would be the first one. The second one is something like, could I protect them from that? You know, is there anything I could do to protect them from that? All right? It's, you get the feeling, the taste, difference. This is Mahayana. Okay, could I do anything to protect them from that? Okay. Frankly, if what we said in the ninth chapter is true, okay? Frankly, if everything we said is true in the ninth chapter, there's only one way you really can help them, and that's to teach them this worldview. Okay? Teach them about emptiness, and then teach them about good deeds, doing goodness. You know, and they have to come together. You can't have one without the other. That's the great weakness of all moral teachings in the West. They don't teach about emptiness. Okay? They don't teach why good deeds work. You see what I mean? If good deeds didn't operate in emptiness, they couldn't work. They can't work. Because things are empty, you can change anything. You see? Because they're empty, you can change anything by doing good deeds. Yeah. He asked about the Bodhisattva vow of not teaching emptiness to people who are not prepared. That is a very, very specific kind of teaching. First of all, in the vow, the people listening have to be people who have already accepted Mahayana Buddhism. Okay? That's first part of that vow. Secondly, you must teach them a special kind of emptiness called turda. It's a special way of presenting emptiness that leaves the listener feeling very, disoriented. Okay? I mean, I've never done that with you. I've never gone through that meditation. I always stop just before that. Okay? Kedub Jay has a good one, etc. Other people have a good one. When we did Friday night class, we always stopped just before we got there. And it's like throwing them off a cliff, you know. If they're strong, if they understand Buddhism well, they can get great insights. And if they're not, you cannot teach it in public. You know what I mean? It's the same emptiness that I'm teaching you. But the presentation is a little scary. So, first of all, the people listening have to be Mahayana already. Secondly, the emptiness you teach them is that scary one, okay? And then, thirdly, they have to, after hearing it, give up Mahayana Buddhism. They have to say, that's too scary, I don't want to do that anymore. I'd rather stick to the, you know, good old plain Hinayana stuff. You see, that's how you break that vow. Also, very importantly, if you teach someone emptiness and you do not immediately teach them ethics or morality, then you've broken that. You see what I mean? Then there's a reason to break that vow. If a person goes straight from emptiness into compassion, if a person goes straight from emptiness into morality, then they're on the right track. You see what I mean? If you give people a wrong teaching on emptiness and you try to teach something weird or something disorienting, or something that just like some black hole in space or something like that, then you really smash that vow. But if you teach it purely and properly to people who have been prepared for a year by two other courses in the Bodhisattva Charvatara, and if you go immediately to compassion and morality, it's perfect, no problem, beautiful, saving their lives. You know what I mean? You have to teach that. You must learn that, and you must spread it. And you can't sit in this class and not teach it. So John said, if people are empty, rather than it being so important to teach other people about compassion, the most important thing would be that you yourself keep your own morality and your own compassion, and then you get enlightened. They're not contradictory. You see what I mean? They're not contradictory. The best thing you can do for other people is to get it yourself. You wouldn't see them as suffering. They would see themselves as suffering. You see what I mean? Very delicate.
And I struggled with that for years, okay? It's not contradictory to say that to me you look like an angel, and that to you you are suffering, because you're empty. You see what I mean? There's no contradiction there. It's a very, very delicate point. It's a very, very delicate point. I can enter a Buddha paradise, and you can be one of the angels in my Buddha paradise, and you can still be in hell. There's no contradiction there, for you. You see what I mean? Absolutely. And there's no contradiction at all that you perceive yourself suffering very badly and I perceive you as an angel. There's no contradiction there at all. If you were not empty, that would be a contradiction. Since you're not empty, there's no contradiction. I could be entering or close to entering a Buddha paradise at this moment, and you can see me as a regular old guy, and you can see your world as a regular old world, and I can be perceiving it as a Buddha paradise. That's the whole point. There's no contradiction. If you think there's a contradiction, you didn't understand emptiness. You see what I mean? Yeah. It's not a contradiction that you're aware of their seeing themselves as suffering. You see what I mean? Yeah, I know what you mean. Because they are suffering. I shouldn't say that. You're right. It seems to be the case, okay? It seems to be the case, okay? Maybe at that point you wouldn't see that. You know. Can a Buddha see suffering beings not in their paradise? You see what I mean? But I believe they can be aware of suffering beings in other realms, like in their own desire realm. One of the qualities of the Sambhogakaya, there are five, what they call the five definite qualities of being in your Buddha paradise. One of them is that you can't meet anybody except 10th level bodhisattvas or better. You know what I mean? And that's one of the qualities. But they don't say that that applies to the realms in which you send down your Nirmanakaya. It's not your suffering, it's their suffering. I gave this debate to Bhavankar Rinpoche when he did his Geshe exam. That was my question to him. And it's not your suffering, you see what I mean? Is it suffering to have to watch it? No. You see what I mean? It's not suffering in that way. Is it unpleasant for them? They feel some kind of compassion. The feeling, the emotional content of the compassion is not being upset or having suffering. That's all. That's the way they answer that question. Because those beings have created the karma to see themselves suffering. Okay.
Yeah.
It's not an easy question, and I struggle with it every day, personally, to tell you the truth. Okay. I do struggle with that question. When Rinpoche was asked that question at McDougal Street 25 years ago, he said, "What do you think Buddhas are going to do? Retire?" And then he stopped. Then he wouldn't say anything else. I don't know. Perhaps you would act the same way towards them either way. How's that? I struggle with it. Okay. I really do. On a daily, on an hourly basis, I struggle with that. Okay.
So
that's the best I could come up with. It seems to me you might have to behave the same either way.
Say Chima, Dan, Laksam, Namdat, Ni, Tenchik. Chima, Dan, Laksam, Namdat, Ni, Tenchik.
Chima means the second one, number two, which is the kind of compassion where you want to protect people from suffering, rather than just some wish that they might get out of it somehow. Okay.
Dung means and. Laksam namdak
is a special concept.
And the word has been mistranslated and abused and all sorts of things. I think it's been translated as not philanthropy, but something that sounds like that. I forget. Anyway, Thasam Namdak means personal responsibility, to take personal responsibility. Ni means those two ideas, those two states of mind. What? Great compassion that wants to protect people from pain. And the state of mind we call taking personal responsibility for their liberation. Dunchik means one and the same. They are exactly the same thing. Okay? The same thing. And I really like the word Laksam Namdat. It very much attracts me. Stilwell was talking about this morning about corporations where some people have Laksam Namdak and some people don't. Laksam Namdak, you have to get. Each person in this room has to reach Laksam Namdak. If I never see you again, if we never have another class, if this is all you ever hear about Buddhism, you should still have Laksam Namdak. Laksam Namdak means I'm going to make sure other people don't suffer anymore. And I don't care if nobody helps me. I don't care if nobody helps me. And trust me, they won't. Okay? All right? You have a Buddhist in the United States or anywhere else has to get into this state of mind. You know, I am going to practice the path. I am going to study all the teachings. I'm going to master them. I'm going to do my meditations. I am going to enter the secret teachings. I personally am going to reach the goals of the secret teachings in this life. And I'm going to get my rear end enlightened so I can help other people. And I don't care if other people don't help me. I don't care if other people don't understand me. I don't care if other people even attack me for what I'm doing. I'm going to do it. You know what I mean? And if you're going to be a real Buddhist, you got to get this state of mind. You have to get into this state of mind. The closer you get to seriously advancing your knowledge, the closer you get to your goal, the more crap will come. You know what I mean? The more problems will come. And the less support you'll seem to get. You see what I mean? Until there'll come a day when you think there's nobody else in the world who cares about what you're doing. You know? You're like, what are other people doing? I don't get it. You know? Nobody seems to be interested in this stuff. I don't care. I'll do it myself. You know what I mean? You have to be able to get into that mode. You know? You will not get support, especially in the United States. You're not going to have dozens of people coming up to you and congratulating you for taking a 1 month off your job for a retreat, you know. And you're not going to get people coming up to you and saying you're brilliant for giving away all your money and stuff like that. It's not going to happen. And I, particularly Sangha, okay, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen that there's going to be people standing in line to feed us and house us and make sure we don't have to work, you know. Forget it. Probably the opposite. You know what I mean? We, Sangha members especially, and then everybody here, you're going to have to do it on your own. You know what I mean? You're not going to get big support from the American public. You know what I mean? And much less, you'll probably get some, probably you get some trouble from people. You see what I mean? And you have to persevere. And you have to be steadfast. And you personally, each person in this room, you have to decide, I'm going to reach the goals of Buddhism and I'm going to help everyone whether anyone helps me or not. It'll be totally unilateral. You know, I don't expect anything from anybody. If I have to pay for the classes I'm teaching, I'll pay for them. You know what I mean? Fine. You know, you have to be that strong about it. And otherwise you'll give up before you... What's ironic is when you get real close to the goal, you start to get more obstacles. And then you're likely to say, to get discouraged, you know, I can't believe these people. There's this story about this Buddhist saint, you know, he's walking down the street in India. This guy comes up to him and says, you're a bodhisattva, right? He says, yeah. He says, give me your eyeball. If you're a bodhisattva, give me, reach into your skull right now and give me your eyeball. I want your eye. So he does, you know, he's like, ew. And he reaches in and he rips it out and he hands it to him, you know, like that, you know. And I don't forget what it is. He hands it with the wrong hand. And the guy takes it and he throws it on the ground and he smashes it, you know, and he says, you know, how could you do that to me? Give me your eyeball with the wrong hand, you know. And the guy got discouraged, you know, he was a high bodhisattva, and he said, people are unbelievable, you know. I'm serving, you know. He says, I'm serving them, you know. I'm practicing day and night. Every single thing I do is to benefit other people. And they're complaining about me, and they're saying, you know, you didn't serve me the way I wanted you to serve me, you know what I mean? And stuff like that, you know. Could you take out your other eyeball, you know, and hand it to me with your right hand, you know. And he got discouraged. There's a very famous story, and he lost a lot of mileage on that in that moment. He like destroyed his bodhisattva attitude, you know. If he had just kept it for another 5 minutes, he would have achieved all these goals, you know what I mean? He lost it. And don't do that, okay? Just don't expect any help, and don't sit around and wait for it. It's not going to happen. Make your meditation perfect. Serve other people. Give away. Use your own money. Use your own resources, and teach them. And you have to. Okay, you have to help other people. And you don't expect, and don't wait for any help. Okay?
Yeah.
The Diamond Cutter Sutra says, and it'll be in Tricycle Magazine like next, I don't know when, Patricia. It came out already, okay. There's a nice article in there about purification by Carlito, right? And in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Buddha says, as you practice this path, all the bad karma you have, the practicing seriously makes it ripen faster and much, much, much less than it would have. So you will get headaches, you will have bad things happen. And for example, like on the day you see emptiness directly or something like that, you could meet demons, you know what I mean? You don't really know if demons exist, you know? We've, modern science and modern sophisticated, you know, civilization has told you there's no such thing. You know, and it's superstitious, and it's stupid, and there's no guy running around with a little sword and a spear and a red tail and all that stuff. You know, there are demons. You know, there are beings like that, and they are not stupid little guys. They are extremely sophisticated. They're extremely intelligent, and they're very, very harmful. And you will have to run into a few, you know, before the whole game is over with. And things like that do happen. I mean, you have to overcome those. There are some great tests before you finish. It does get more and more pleasant as you overcome each test, you know what I mean? As you overcome each obstacle, they will come, you know. The reason modern man hasn't met any demons is that they're quite happy with our progress and they leave us alone. You know, if we continue like that, everything is great, you know. You try to start a class like this, you know, you try to start practicing seriously, you'll meet a few of them, you know. But just have Laksam Namdak, you know, kick their ass, you know. That's all. And you will, and you can. But don't think they don't exist, they do. Mm-hmm. And they're not stupid little Casper the Ghost or something like that. Okay, yeah. Yeah, Laksam Namdak is the final step before you get bodhicitta. You know, deciding, because you have compassion, Nyingje Chenpo, to undertake personal responsibility, to take personal responsibility for helping other people. That's the immediate predecessor to bodhicitta itself. It's the last step before you reach true bodhicitta. Just before final bodhicitta, yeah. Okay, yeah. They are. The second half of Nyingje Chenpo is Dzogchen. Okay? Alright. Let's see here. I think we'll take a break there. Okay? Alright. 10 minutes, alright? at the very end of the book, Master Shantideva, he pulls off a big trick on everybody. And I think by this time he was well on his way south into South India in the sky. And remember, people argued whether or not he ever taught a 10th chapter. And he saved the perfection of giving for last. He didn't, he didn't cover it yet. Like he forgot the first perfection, you know. But he's very clever. You see, he wants to have something to give before he covers the perfection of giving. So he just gave the most precious thing. So his last action in the book is to give away the virtue of doing the book. You see what I mean? So he's going to give away the good deed of doing the book, and we can do the same with the good deed of studying it for a year, okay? So now you have something to give, all right? And that's, in his case, it's finishing his book. All the Indian pandits, before they wrote a book, they prayed that they can have the virtue to finish it. And some of them never finished their books, and we still have them in the Tengir, and they stop halfway through a page, you know. The person died or something happened, and he's finished it. And so he wants to give away the good deed. He wants to dedicate the virtue. So he covers the perfection of giving by giving away the good deed of what he just did, which is probably the best gift he could have given away. And he couldn't do it at the beginning of the book because he wasn't finished yet. Okay, so if you remember the seven limbs or the seven components of your practice, of what practice? We'll cover it. Te sakchang ki ne dupe yenla dimbe nangsen tu kyurpe ngo. Okay. Sakchang means when you do any kind of activity, especially your morning meditation, your morning practice, first you have to collect good energy and you have to get rid of your negative energy. Okay? Sak means you collect good energy. And that's that process of preparing for meditation that we're talking about on Monday evenings, and it's the way to get into meditation. And some of those seven components are meant to collect positive energy for the success of your meditation. Jang means getting rid of negative energy, purifying negative energy that's going to hurt your meditation. Ne means crucial point. In other words, if you know the seven steps to do this, you can save a lot of time and money. You know what I mean? They're very, very effective. Dupa means it includes those, everything you need to know. Yenla Dumba means the seven steps. The seven steps. And that's what you do before meditation. Nangsen to Gyopa means here's one of them. In fact, it happens to be number seven. Okay, Nangsen to Gyopa means here's one of them. What is it? Ngoa. Okay, Ngoa means dedicating a good deed that you did. So Master Shantideva is killing two birds with one stone. He's going to wrap up his book and he's going to dedicate the virtue. And by dedicating that good deed, he's going to show you how to do the perfection of giving. You see what I mean? So his excuse the way he's presenting the perfection of giving is to dedicate what he just did. Okay? And that's going to be the perfection of giving. That's all he says about the perfection of giving. All right? Yeah, I'll translate it. You go backwards, right? Dedication, which is a member of the group of seven components that include in them all the crucial points of how to collect good karma and purify bad karma. Okay? So if on your homework it said, you know, what was, how did Master Shantideva get out of teaching the perfection of giving? Well, he taught dedication, which is the last and the most, one of the most crucial of the seven steps that you use to collect good energy and dispel bad energy. Okay? You have to know, by the way, the difference between say ngoa munlam. Ngoa munlam. Ngoa means dedication. Name of the 10th chapter. Which is a trick to teach you the perfection of giving, right? And then munlam means a prayer. A prayer. Like the great prayer festival in Hase is called Munlam Chemo, for example. What's the difference between a ngoa and a munlam? What's the difference between dedication and prayer? Dedication is when you have just done some very powerful good karma. Okay? When you've just done some very powerful good karma. Okay? Then you ngoa, you dedicate it. It's like putting it into bank. Okay? Mainly it has two effects. Okay? Mainly it has two effects. What the first one is positive and the second one is negative. Okay? The first one, the positive one is if you think about anything nice in your life, let's say your own body, okay? Your own body. Whether you have a beautiful body or not, or a healthy body or not, it still works. It got you here tonight. You have to thank you, Mr. Body, you know? Your body is a result of a good karma, okay? But it's what we call a dirty good karma. Dirty good karma means it's going to wear out, okay? So it's a good karma, but it's a dirty good karma. It's going to wear out, right? If you do ngoa with any virtue, it will turn into pure good karma. You see what I mean? Especially if you understand the emptiness of your good deed. You know, while you're doing the good deed, while you're doing a whole year's course in the Bodhisattva Charitamatara, you're thinking, I'm empty. The person studying, the person sitting in this pew is empty. Great. Now I can make him into a tantric deity. You know, if he or she wasn't empty, I'd be up the creek. You know, thank goodness he or she is empty. Now everything's possible. Okay, the person studying, the book itself, the lectures are also empty. Some people were bored. Some people went home and never came back. You know, some people heard something interesting. And they were studying words, you know. There were people, it seemed, that were just studying words, you know. Oh, I learned a new word tonight. Oh, I'm not so interested in that. I already know that word. You know what I mean? Some people were getting the class on the level of words, you know. And then some people were thinking, maybe I'll meet some nice people here, you know, or something like that, some other motivation. And then a few people got it, you know. A few people were like, oh my God, you know. First of all, everything I've been taught in my life up to now doesn't work, you know. And here's something that if it's true, then I don't have to die. I really don't have to die, you know. If it's true what he said, then I can actually change that and everything else about my life, you know. I can have all my loved ones forever, you know. I can have a body that's perfect, you know. I can have the high school cheerleader, you know, stuff like that. I mean, all things are possible if they're empty. And you don't have to lose them later on. You see what I mean? And then some people got it, you know. So the teaching is empty. Different people are hearing different things. You know, you're empty. You could be a normal person. You've got a choice now. You can. It's a flow chart, right? A certain percentage will die. A certain percentage will die and go to some kind of suffering. A certain percentage will die and go to some kind of happiness. And a certain percentage, if they're lucky, won't die at all. I mean, they'll practice secret Buddhism and they'll just not have to die. And they'll enter some kind of paradise. You know. So everything is empty. You're empty. I'm empty. The class was empty. You know what I mean? There didn't have to be this class. Because of the virtue of everyone in this room tonight, this class is happening. You know, if you weren't here and you didn't have the virtue, this class wouldn't be happening. There wouldn't be this class. that virtue is also wearing out. You know what I mean? That virtue, you have to be careful. That virtue is very expensive. You know what I mean? So the class is empty, you're empty, and the book is empty. Okay? Everything about that is empty. There's a whole emptiness going on. And you can either take the virtue of doing this class and just kind of enjoy some results you're going to get from it, or you can very consciously, and I suggest when we finish tonight, you know, during the meditation, you put it in the bank, okay? If you dedicate it to becoming an enlightened being in this life, to help other people. You see, I always thought helping other people would be a big hassle. You know, like helping people on the subway is a big hassle. You might miss your stop. You might be late to work. It's a hassle to help other people, you know. But in Buddhism, it's not. You see, the best way to help other people is to be enlightened. Enlightenment happens to be the most blissful thing you can do. And the path to enlightenment, which is keeping your vows, all three sets of vows, is the most exciting and turned on and happy and blissful thing you can do anyway. So Master Shantideva said, a blissful path to highest bliss. You see what I mean? Doing it is fun. Blissful. It's very cool to keep your vows. It's a lot of fun. If you start getting into it, there's nothing like it. There's no kind of sensual pleasure. There's no kind of mental pleasure. There's no kind of any kind of pleasure which is as fun as being a bodhisattva. You know what I mean? And the result is that you get ultimate pleasure. So, you know, twist my arm. You know, it's cool. It's really fun. It's really fun. So dedicated to that, you know. And Master Shantideva says at this point, any small thing you ever do, you know, I was sitting with this really good Buddhist, you know, and we were eating, it wasn't sugar, okay? It was like a croissant or something. And this sparrow came in to the door of the cafe, and we're sitting there and we throw a few crumbs to them. And then we're like whispering, you, within three lifetimes, are going to study ninth chapter with me. You know what I mean? It's like a trick, you know, and you say, come on, come on, come on. And you throw it, you know, just the right way, and they're like scared, and then they get a little closer, and you say, come on, come on, come on. And they're like getting closer and closer, and you say, come on, ninth chapter, ninth chapter. And then they take it, and they eat it, you know, and you say, all right, you know, I got you, you know. You know, three lives, you know, I got you, you know. And you can do that all day long. It's not some stupid fantasizing. They are a sentient being. If you have the right energy, and if they pick up that energy from you, you can do it. So don't, Master Shantideva at this point says, dedicate everything. You know, the smallest little things, it's more fun actually to dedicate small things. It really is. You give some kid a candy, you know, and say some prayer in your mind, you know, like, you're going to be, you know, my friend in Buddha Field number 34, you know, and we're going to hang out together, and you can play your tuba, all right, or whatever. You know what I mean? And you can think like that, and you can do anything for anybody. But Master Shantideva says, don't blow the chance. You know, anytime you do something good, if you don't think like that, it becomes dirty karma, you see? If you don't, and also if you don't understand the emptiness, it becomes dirty karma. And then it just wears out. But if you're thinking in the back of your mind, you are going to learn the perfection of wisdom from me, you know? And when I get to be a Buddha, you're going to be with me. You know, we're going to toast together the nectar of immortality, you know. Why? Because I tricked you into taking this piece of bread from me, you know. And all the time, all day long, think like that. It's not some stupid fantasy. It works. It really works. So dedicate everything to that, he's saying. The difference between dedication and prayer is, with dedication you have some kind of raw material to work with. What is it? Virtue. You did something good. And you say, I don't want this to become some dirty karma. I don't want to get a Lexus from this karma. I'm going for the big time, you know. I want Manjushri's hair, you know. That's what I want this thing to produce, you know. Why? Because when I get to be this incredibly blissful, incredibly beautiful deity, I'm going to go teach other people how to do it. You know what I mean? And there's this thing about doing it yourself that other people smell. You know, if you've done it yourself, people smell it. And if you haven't done it yourself, people smell it. So do it, right? And all the time think in your mind, I'm going to do it for my mother, I'm going to do it for my brother, I'm going to do it to help other people, you know. And it happens to be the most fun you can ever have anyway, so why not? You see what I mean? That's munlam. Sorry, loa. Munlam means a general prayer without having done any specific virtue that you're dedicating. Munlam is a nice wish. Loa is an investment. You see what I mean? Big difference, okay? Munlam is like some kind of nice wish. Loa, you know, you've got something to invest. You know, I was just a joke, okay? I'm not saying it's really. I'll give a facetious example, okay? So I gave somebody this little diamond on last Saturday. Not so small, okay? Pretty nice. And on Sunday, this lady gave me a pretty big diamond. So I was thinking, gee, that was fast. And you know. No, sorry, I gave it away on Friday. I got the big diamond on Saturday. On Sunday, I went and gave it to Ken Rinpoche. You see? This is reinvestment. You see? And that's how you have to think, you know. Don't waste your virtues, you know. Anytime you get something, turn it over, you see. Turn it over immediately. It's really, really cool. And it keeps snowballing, you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not talking money is the only thing, but that's just one example. Things will happen like that. Just keep giving, you know. Just every time you get something back, then just give it away again, you know. And dedicate it. Trick the people around you, you know. You are going to be in my Buddha paradise, you know. Okay, that's the difference between loa and a munla. Okay, so in a positive sense, even little actions like giving, in that case, it was like giving a few crumbs to a sparrow. It turns into some incredible virtue. Like, you don't have to live your life as an ordinary person, especially if you're a kirimba. You know, you don't have to live that way anymore. You don't have to think of anything as ordinary anymore. Little things that you do have profound karmic results, you know. Giving a piece of bread to a bird can result in a Buddha paradise. And that's very, very much part of the tantric teachings and everything. You know, they constantly saying, if you know how to give a piece of bread to a bird, you know, that virtue is unbelievable. You can't measure that virtue, you know. Like, people who understand emptiness know how to give a piece of bread to the bird. How? Remember the emptiness of the bird. They can become your student. Remember the emptiness of you. You can become Vajrapani or Vajrayogini or anybody you want, you know. And you can meet them in the future. And there's no problem there. So you have to... The world is struggling to make you think ordinary thoughts. You know, New York City, the people around you, the New York Times, they're struggling to make you think you're a normal person. And that nothing special is going on. You know, and if you go to somebody at work and say, you wouldn't believe what's happening in my life. You should see all the neat things that are happening. They'll try to debunk it as fast as they can. I mean, the world wants to convince you that your life is just some stupid, ordinary thing. And it's not. Okay, especially if you're sitting here tonight, forget it. You know, you're one of 100 Americans or 200 Americans to go through the whole Bodhisattva Charvatara. You know, if you think you're just a normal person, forget it. You know, and don't let people convince you of that. You know, you're walking around New York, you know, setting up your future paradise. And you're selecting, you're volunteering all these candidates to be with you, dear. You see what I mean? And don't think of it any other way. You know, go through New York. Everything's empty. It doesn't have to be like that. Every building, every sidewalk, every subway, every other person, you know, go ahead and fantasize. It works. It actually works. When you get to the secret teachings, that's a major component of the secret teachings. It works. It really does work. Okay. Negatively, if you don't dedicate it, what will happen to that good deed? It becomes dirty good karma. Okay. It becomes just plain old dirty good karma. What will you get? You'll get a Michael and Zoe's milkshake that runs out. Okay? And you won't remember it the next day. And it'll be gone. Okay? And then all that stuff is wasted. You know, all that effort is wasted. So dedicate it. Dedicate it that I will move into my angel's body in this lifetime. And I'm doing this deed for that. How many deeds should you dedicate? If you've been doing the book and you heard about the book, you know. It's not these huge, big, good deeds, okay? It's not like you're going to save a million people's lives or stuff like that. It's not like that. Dedicate the little things you do. Master Shantideva is very adamant about starting small. Dedicate even the little stuff you do. If you clean the bathroom at 6th Street, dedicated to your future enlightenment. You know, if you clean up a table which is messy, dedicated to your future enlightenment. You know, if you say good morning to somebody at work, dedicated to your future enlightenment. Because that's the realm we're in. And that's the raw material. And it does create your future enlightenment. You know, don't just wait for, you know, the next time you get $1 million to save, you know, thousands of people. It's not like that. Yeah. Immediately. You know, every time I have a flower to give to my lama, I like run and give it to them because I might die. You see what I mean? You got to do it quick. You know, the minute you think of a good deed, just do it. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. You know, sometimes you feel uncomfortable. People will think I'm eccentric, you know. Forget it, you know. All those people are going to die. At least you can die eccentrically enlightened. You know what I mean? And don't worry about it. You know, don't worry so much. The whole world wants you to be normal. And the whole world is trying to convince you that all this stuff is not real. This is more real than they are. You know what I mean? This is the real thing. Yeah. He said, can you keep dedicating it? For sure, yeah. You can keep rejoicing in something you did. You know, if you were the director of some Dharma center in California and it was really hard work and no one ever helped you and stuff like that, but you were obeying your Lama's wishes by doing that, yeah, keep dedicating it. Every time you get irritated, say, no, well, wait a minute, I can dedicate this and just dedicate it, you know what I mean? And then you keep getting, you can get, the investment can be made over and over again, no problem. I had a friend, he says, he sees a good parking spot on the street where he lives and he doesn't want to take it because he says he used up his good karma, you know. Forget it. I mean, if you understand emptiness, you go to a store, you get the nicest, biggest dessert they have and you sit there and eat it, you know, and you dedicate it. Like I was surfing and dedicating it to Ken Rinpoche or Geshe Darge, you know. Great. No problem. You know, you don't have to think like that. How do you think Buddhas perpetuate their paradises, you know? Do they deny themselves those ecstasies? You know, no, they consume them and create more. They turn it around. They dedicate it. They reinvest it and they get more in than they put in. More out than they put in, right? Like that. Okay? You don't have to worry about that. Enjoy your life. Enjoy everything you have. Enjoy music, enjoy your friends, enjoy nice food, whatever, you know. And dedicate it. And it's more powerful than saying, oh, I shouldn't eat it or something like that. You know, go ahead. You know, it's great. That's the whole point. And the more you dedicate it, the more things are going to happen to dedicate. And it's just a big snowball. That's the whole idea. Okay. Okay, last thing. What is that? Yeah, we'll skip that one. At the very, very, now we're at the end of the 10th chapter. Okay. By the way, the 10th chapter, we don't have time to go through it in detail. I thought it was more important to go through the emptiness in some detail. But it's a very, very beautiful chapter. You know, if you should read it, there's a couple of translations out. They're probably pretty good. And read it. The 10th chapter is very, very beautiful. Master Shantideva goes through just about every kind of suffering you can imagine in the whole universe. And he prays that he could become the antidote, you know. So like he's praying for all the people in the hells, and he's praying that he could become a rain cloud, and that he could be the raindrops and drop down on them. He prays for the crops in every corner of the world. He prays that every pregnant woman who's delivering today should have a nice, smooth delivery, you know. And all these beautiful prayers. I mean, it's really, really beautiful. It just felt to me like you either go through the whole thing or you don't. And I didn't know how to choose one of them. They're so beautiful. And it goes on for page after page. It's really beautiful. It's so beautiful that in Tibetan Buddhist monasteries, we just do that chapter as a prayer. You know, we read it and just follow the prayer that he's making, the dedication that he's making. So you should try to get the translation and read it. I didn't have time. It's a little bit long to translate. And I think it would have to be done very beautifully. You know, it had to be done in a deep retreat or something like that. And I was in New York, so what I did do, I went straight to the last one, the very, very last dedication he makes, okay? And to me, it's the most important one, okay? And I'll show it to you. And it must have been the most important for him too, because he saved it to the last, okay? Okay, so Drowe Dungel Man Chikpu Demba Yuning Nagyo Chik.
The final dedication he makes, you know, of all the dedications, he goes through every single suffering of mankind and he dedicates the virtue of his book. And we can dedicate the virtue of studying the book. Sometimes I think we did a bigger virtue because it's harder for us than it was for him, I think. You could dedicate it. This is his final dedication. These are the last two lines of dedication. This is what he chooses as the most important thing to dedicate to. And I would propose that we do the same thing.
Drowa means living beings, all kinds of living beings.
Dungyal means their pain, physical and mental pain. Man means medicine that cures the pain. Okay. I'm going to skip Chikpu for now, okay? Save it for later. Demba means these teachings, okay? This system of teaching. I don't think it really matters whether you call it Buddhism or not. You know, if you can teach somebody, it doesn't matter whether you call it Buddhism or not. If you can teach somebody about the emptiness of the pen and teach them that it applies to themselves, and then get them to understand virtue, good deeds, compassion, they will enter an enlightened body and mind. You see what I mean? I don't think it even matters if you ever call it Buddhism or not. It doesn't really matter at all. You know, what can you do to get people to understand that the pen is not the pen from the pen side? It's your mind that's making it the pen. If it were the pen from its own side, then to a dog that walked in here, it would seem like a pen. You see what I mean? But you think of it as a pen because of your own karma. And he thinks of it as a chewable thing because it is his own karma. And the only thing that's out there is blue and white colors and a cylinder shape. You know, and that's all your eye can see. Your eye cannot see pen. Teach somebody this truth. It's a truth. And then teach somebody that that makes you eligible for enlightenment. You know, your body is empty. It doesn't have to be like this. You're seeing it a certain way because of your past karma. If you were compassionate, if you served other people, you'd see something totally different. And you wouldn't have to die, and there wouldn't have to be all the suffering that's going on in this realm. It's not necessary. Okay? Teach them that. That's the teachings. I don't think it's totally irrelevant whether you call it Buddhism or not. It doesn't matter.
Yunring means
long time. Long time. Nagyo Chik means may they stay. May these teachings stay in the world. Okay? Because they are the medicine that cures the pain of every being. Okay? I want to talk about Chikpu, okay? Remember Chikpu?
Here's Chikpu.
Chikpu means the one and only one, the one and only medicine. Okay. And I think it's the most important word here. Okay? It means if what I say is true about the pen, if the principle of karma is correct, if by serving others good things come to you, and if by hurting others bad things come to you, if it's true, and all the religions of the world are flirting with that idea, more or less, you know, they're more or less, they all are saying, if you hurt others, you will suffer. If you serve others, you will be happy. Pleasure will come to you. In my mind, Buddhism explains it much more clearly with the idea of emptiness. You know, because things are empty, and because karma is stored in your mind, when you see yourself doing good things or when you see yourself doing bad things, then every object in the world takes its content from that. You know, whether it feels good to you or feels bad to you, whether it makes you happy or not, whether you die or not, all depends on how you treat other people. You see? I don't think that in my own experience, that hasn't been expressed to me by any other
teaching except this one. You see what I mean? And I say it's true, and you can confirm it yourself. You know what I mean? You have to try it and confirm it yourself. But suppose it is true. I always say suppose. Okay? I'm not saying it is. Okay? But suppose it is true. Then on the negative side, all the other systems are they're incomplete. Why? They don't explain. Why? My mother died. I mean, for me, that's all I need. You know, they do not explain it. They don't even try to explain it. You know, they say she got cancer. I say, why her? She wasn't at the average death, you know, she was 40-something. You know, she wasn't 70.3 years, you know. So why? Why did she get it? Oh, she smoked. Millions of other people smoked, they didn't get cancer, you know. Why her? You know, I mean, I understand that the smoke caused the cell, caused the division, caused the tumor, caused the brain, caused the death, you know. But that's not the answer to my question. The question was, why did she get it? You see what I mean? Why did she have that happen? And any system that you're going to follow should answer that. If it doesn't answer that, give it up. You see what I mean? It's incomplete. And you can say, those things have no answers. And I don't buy it. You know, you might as well kill yourself as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? And my brother did, for example, when my mother died. You know, if that's the way it is, then I don't see any point to life, to living. You know, if there's no answer to that thing, I don't see any point to it. You might as well just stop it. You know, it's obviously pretty suffering. You know, you might as well just stop it. If there's no answer to those things, then you should just give up. The second one is dysfunctional. There's some kind of fancy spelling, right? Oh, well. Is it like that? Is it? Dysfunctional. Dysfunctional means that the point of human life, the point of human activity, the point of every person's every action and word and thought is only one thing. People want to be happy. I mean, you can say, we're not trying to be happy here, we're trying to sell cars, you know. But you're selling cars because you want to be happy. I mean, there's nothing basically that any human being does except that they think it might make them happy. Even sadomasochists who beat themselves, they like to have, they get some kind of happiness out of it. You see what I mean? There's nobody, even people who commit suicide, think they might be happier. You see what I mean? They believe that. It's better than not. You see what I mean? And it's the goal of all human life to be happy. It's not just some Dalai Lama, smiley, compassion thing. You know, it really, truly, it's not like he's just some irrelevant fringe person who's running around the world telling everybody they can be happy, like have a nice day, you know. And it kind of, it not only doesn't make you happy, it makes you disgusted in a way. You know, it's like, what do you mean have a nice day? You know, I'm not having a nice day. You know what I mean? I mean, don't think of the happiness of mankind as just some weird idea of some Tibetan guy who's running around the world. It's not like that. It's really is truly what everybody wants. And it's not a side issue, it is the issue. You know, people want to be happy. And that's why everyone does everything they do. And you can talk to me all night about it, but I don't believe you if you say anything else. People want to be happy. And the viewpoints that we hold now don't work at all. They just don't work. But we continue to cling to them. It's weird. You know what I mean? It takes some kind of, you know, disaster in your life or some kind of miracle for you to wake up, you know, that this way of looking at the world, which is so reasonable and fashionable and scientific, doesn't work at all. It doesn't make anybody happy, you know. So you have to find a viewpoint or a system which is not incomplete. It does explain why my mother died, and it does make people ultimately happy. And if it's not possible, if it's not possible, then I would just kill myself, or, you know, I'd wait for a while until things got worse, you know, like until the credit card company caught up with me, you know. But if it's not possible, I don't see much point in going on like this. I mean, you're not happy, and life is really bad. So if it's not possible, then just give up, you know. But it does happen to be possible, and it's not possible with what you're using now. The present system by which Western people live doesn't work. It's very possible that, you know, a billion people are making a boo-boo. It's not impossible, okay? And it's also possible that you can fix it with a certain worldview. What is it? Things are empty, and therefore things can change. And if you collect enough virtue, and if you teach the people around you to do virtue, then I say it's possible that in 50 or 100 years, the majority of people in the United States could be following a totally different way of life, and that they would be extremely happy, and that honestly and sincerely, and you should imagine, a certain percentage of them have entered their own Buddha paradise, you know, and will not be dying this time, you know. I mean, the obituary page would go out of business, right? And imagine it. I'm saying imagine it, okay? When you dedicate, what did Master Shantideva think was important enough to dedicate about? These ideas spreading to other countries. These ideas spreading in the world. And I say, imagine it. Just try to imagine it. You know, we're going to dedicate the virtue of this class later on. Just try to imagine what would happen if the whole country was behaving along the lines of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Try to imagine it. And if what I said is true, try to imagine a significant number of people entering their own Buddha paradise. You know, imagine it. And then dedicate the virtue of this class to that. Okay? Dedicate the virtue of what you did to that. Okay? Tonight. Don't think I'm crazy, and don't think it's impossible. It's happened in other countries. You know, it works. You know, and the other thing doesn't work, so why not give it a try? Okay? The other system doesn't. It just flatly doesn't work. Okay? So give it a try. Okay, last thing. That's not the last line. It's the last line of dedication. And here's his last line. And then you get to go home. Right on time. Almost. Hey, Daki. Gila. Gewe. Cho, Tarwar, Zepe, Gewe, Shenyen, La, Da, Chaktel, Lo. Okay. This is the final words of the book. Okay. And Dak means me. Daki means my. Okay. Gyu here means, the best word in English is your heart, in your heart. Okay, it means mind or heart. Gila. Gewe Chok means the virtuous side of things. Gewe Chok means all the goodness that there is. Okay, goodness itself. Okay. Darwar Zepa means to spread. Spread them. Okay. It's a pun, okay? He just prayed that the teaching should darwa throughout the world. And now he's praying that goodness should darwa in his own heart. You see, because the darwa is normally used for spreading teachings into new countries and stuff like that, okay? Darwa.
So the person who spreads all goodness in my own heart
My Gewe Shenyin, okay? Gewe Shenyin. Gewe Shenyin is an old Sanskrit word, Kalyana Mitra. And it means your lama, your root lama, okay? Your lama. Gewa means virtue, Shenyin means friend. Okay? Virtue buddy, okay? Your lama. The shortened version is Geshe, okay, and that's where that word comes from. Right? La to that lama, dark eye. Dark means eye. Chaksel means I bow down, I prostrate to my lama. Okay. We just finished going through the whole Bodhisattva Charvatara. Okay, we went through all 10 chapters, and the book is extremely, extremely powerful. I mean, the ideas there could transform whole nations. You know, the ideas there can transform millions and millions of people's minds, and the ideas there can save millions of people from death, literally. Okay, you can't study it, and it won't work unless you find a lama, your own heart lama. Okay, so each person here, you have to go find your lama. You know, you have to. You can't do it without some holy being who comes to you and helps you. Okay, it's impossible. You have to go find this person. Okay. And it's a long journey, you know. It might take a long time, but you have to find that one being who can really spread these things in your heart, you know. And, you know, I can get up and teach you and stuff like that. You may or may not have that relationship with me, but you have to find that person, okay? You have to personally go and find the person that fits you and that you have the karma that they can actually drag you into your Buddha paradise, okay? And they will, and they do, okay? But you have to find that person. You know, this whole book and all this study, all this homework and quizzes, you know, all these hours of work, it doesn't mean anything if you don't have a lama. You know, you have to go find your lama, and don't be shy about it. And when you find them, glue yourself to them, because you can't get to a Buddha paradise unless they help you. You need to find them. Okay? You need to find that person. And you should check carefully, take your time. Don't just take the first one you meet. Check out many, many people. Find the one that fits you perfectly. And then just give yourself to them. Okay? And let them lead you to there. There's a lot of things that you have to do to get there that you can't do on your own. Impossible. And you will actually fight with them. You know what I mean? If you use a lama, if you find your lama, they know special ways to get you there much faster than you could ever do on your own. And some of them are not what you would guess. And sometimes it's uncomfortable. You know, and sometimes it's like, I don't know, you know, they're telling me to do this, but it's not what I would do. But you just do it. You see what I mean? They know your future. They see everything. And they know what's the best thing for you at that moment. And just give yourself up to them. You know what I mean? Just make sure they're a pure lama first. You know what I mean? You don't give yourself up to anybody. You're very precious, you know. Your mind is very precious. And check them out. I mean, in scripture, oftentimes the student checked out the lama for 12 years or something. It's very common. You know. I mean, go look, find a pure one, test them, check them, ask other people, you know, examine their behavior, examine what they teach, and spend your life trying to find this person. And then when you find them, you know, glue yourself to them, and then listen, you know, keep your ears open and follow what they say, and then devote yourself to them, and then you can do all this stuff. And frankly, you can't do it without that. It won't work. It just won't work. So find that person. You have to. And that, so he's bowing at the end. Who is his lama? Just before this, he mentions bowing down to Manjushri. Apparently, he was bowing, you know, he was getting coached by Manjushri, okay? And eventually, if you find a lama, and if you can live with them in the proper way, then they will be it. You'll see that they are a tantric deity. There are all these tantric deities waiting. There's one special one. They've been trying to reach you. They've been working very hard to reach you. And you have to follow them. You know, you have to find them. When you do, then give yourself to them. And you'll reach your paradise. Okay? So like that. That's all. That's actually all I have. So we'll do a little meditation. And then don't cop out on Thursday. Come. Okay, Thursday is the review class, and it's very, very important. And don't think it's not important. It's probably the most important class. So come on Thursday. I suspect you might get out a little early. I don't make any guarantees, okay? But don't cop out. That's a very important class. Okay? We'll go over the whole final exam. Okay? And I thank you for making me do it, okay? Because you don't know what I'm perceiving unless you're enlightened. I don't know. But for me, you know, this is the most precious thing that I have the opportunity to do. And for me, it's an incredible blessing. And I suppose if there were a bunch of tantric deities in New York, they would just, you know, trick me into teaching them the Bodhisattva Charvatara, so thanks, okay? Meditate for like a few minutes and dedicate it, okay?
This is the end of Class 10. You have been listening to A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Part 3, with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.